You're listening to a podcast by the United Nations Research Institute for Social Development and the United Nations Non-Governmental Liaison Service.
One asks why, what is the role of governments for supporting complementary currencies? I would like to point out that in general, one is not aware of the role of governments to actually support the conventional currency, because it is not what's being taught in economics. Okay? We all have been told that governments are supposed to use taxes because that they need to fund themselves, just like a family. You know, you need to have income. That's about a 300-year-old lie if you are a sovereign government. So the real purpose for taxes from a systemic perspective is to give a value to a currency that has none intrinsically. If governments were not requiring taxes to be paid in a particular currency and that everybody obliged to pay taxes, of conventional money, dollars, euros, Swiss francs, nobody would bother using them. So it's as simple as that. It would have no value. So that's the first point to be aware of. The reason that all complementary currencies will always be marginal compared to the conventional one, the official one, is there. Okay? The day that a government decides to choose a second currency in parallel or separately or in addition to the other thing, that game, the game will change. So that's the first point. Second point. Practically, I'm going to be careful because I don't have real hard statistics on this, but the vast majority of complementary currencies is what I call push currencies. Someone issues a currency, either an NGO or a group of people or whatever the entity, to make things happen, and is pushing this currency down on people. Okay? There is another way. It's what I call pull. They are scarcer, but they're 10 times more powerful. The first type of pull is an obligation. We're going back to what I said about governments a few minutes ago. In other words, if the government were issuing a currency, it could be a government for a city. It doesn't have to be the central government. Issues a currency to make things happen and says you need to bring some of this currency if you want to live in this town, this currency could be a lot more valuable than the national currency, depending on how much they issue and how much they require. So that's an obligation mechanism. There is a second model, which is, of course, more popular because it is, you know, politically a lot easier. Putting a new obligation on people is not people something that's politically not particularly palatable. It's an attraction. If you design a currency that is the only means to something that people want, you will have the phenomenon that people say, where do I find that currency? All right? You don't have to push it on to people. They'll gum and hunt for it, just like they would do for national currency. So that's what I call realizing dreams. And you need to do this, in other words, in another way than what we are currently doing, which is basically typically the push model. Let me briefly explain the mechanism, the economic mechanism, the way I see it, for a complementary currency. Any complementary currency, including the ones that I've been talking about, which would be the pull ones. What you need to do is look at the conventional economy as an ocean or a huge piece of water somewhere. That's where all the fish are. That's where all the bulk of the water is. That's where the normal economy is. There is a second thing. That's where the whole economic field is talked about. But there are always things that are actually sticking out that are not part of that. They're unmet needs and unused resources that are not part of this ocean. When the economy has done its thing, the market, there are either enough people around who don't have the means to get their needs met, and there are not lots of resources that are not used, including people, by the way. Okay? So what is a complementary currency? It is actually a mechanism to bridge these two. Now, I'm going to give you a commercial example which has absolutely no social value, but because everybody's familiar with it. It's 40 years old. It's the frequent flyer miles. This was actually the prototype for the commercial application of complementary currencies 40 years ago. And what did they do? What was the unmet need? Was customer loyalty from an airline perspective. People were not going to take the same airline repeatedly unless they were forced to it or attracted to it. And the unused resource was an empty seat. That's why there are blocks of periods where you cannot use your miles. So there's a management function to link these two things to make sure that's an unused seat. So that is the mechanism. And we can apply that to any other field, including in a city or including in a country. So that's the mechanism, that is the general rule. But the important thing is to understand the unmet needs and unused resources, and that's the function to bridge it. You can design a currency that does specific targets on both ends. I'm going now to give examples, two of the attraction model and one of the obligation model. The attraction model dates back to 2010 when I was approached by the city of Ghent. They gave me the poorest neighborhood of all of Flanders, which has all the characteristics of problems that we are familiar with. It's the problème de banlieue in the French environment, the ghettos in the United States, areas of problems. This is economically literally the poorest neighborhood of all of Flanders. 50% newcomers, new immigrants, 20 languages, Turkish dominant. That's the social environment. And the challenge was make this a nice neighborhood where people say hello and don't drop papers on the street. Okay? They tried a lot of things to make that happen and it didn't work. So what did we do? We started off by actually making a survey. What are these people dreaming of? What do they really want that they don't have? And the answer was a bit of a garden. In Anatolia, everybody has land. And I learned from gardening from my grandfather, and I have kids, and I don't know what to do. I don't have a square meter. I'm living on the 13th floor of a building, okay, where I don't have access for a square meter. So that's what we did. This is the result. There was a factory that had been gone bankrupt. Several hectares of land is there, but not really soil. By the way, this is the cement floor of the ex-factory, okay? We gave them access to 4 square meters for the cost of 250 torukas per year. You can only rent these things for 250 torukas. You cannot buy them for €1 million, okay? That's not what you can do. That's what you can get. And immediately you got the answer, well, how the hell will we find those torukas? Well, here's a whole list of things. Here's what the torukas look like. This is a 10 toruk in one of the buildings where people are living. This is another view of the neighborhood. That's 10 torukas. They could also use them not only for the gardens, but for all the things that the city has been trying to promote. Low energy lamps, things like seasonal fruit, seasonal vegetables. And here's how you earn torukas. Clean up the neighborhood. Here is another way. Plant flowers. Make your beautiful neighborhood beautiful. Well, the result has been that the city of Ghent had more volunteers than it could actually, that it thought about. They had to create new programs in order to have enough people, more people that they do it. So that's been the result. In addition, from an economic perspective, for the same budget, they had about 3 to 20 times, 3 times in the first year. And when it's fully developed, the estimate could go up to 20 times more results in the field than if you just did it with euros. Okay? Now, second example of a pool currency. This has been designed for Lithuania. Lithuania is one of the Baltic countries that became independent from Russia in the late 90s. It was actually the first one to do that. They have the first president who is a woman today, and the president has expressed the idea that she wants to have Lithuania become a country where people come to learn. Of course, she couldn't quite say you should come to Lithuania for the warm beaches or for the pyramids or the Greek temples, because there aren't any, right? So they should look for something else. And that was her objective, that the population should become trilingual. Most of them are bilingual today, Lithuanian and Russian or Polish. Everybody starts using the internet more efficiently, learning through the internet, and actually intergenerational learning. These are the components of the agenda. This system is not operational, as opposed to the previous one. It is being actually in the feasibility phase right now in Lithuania this year. There are two advantages that Lithuania has compared to other countries. The first one is it has actually overtaken Sweden in 2010 to be the most cabled country in the world. Okay? Of course, they're not very large. They have 3 million people to deal with, so, you know. And the second point is there's 120% penetration of mobile phones, including the babies. So that basically means that everybody has two SIM cards, okay? So that's the characteristics that they're dealing with. We start with a dream. There's a citizen, anybody, a group of people or an individual has a dream, and whatever that dream is. And we create a Lithuanian Learning Foundation that will make an agreement, a contract, with that citizen to make this dream happen at a certain condition. The condition being expressed in doras. A dora is 1 hour of teaching or learning. Okay? So, for example, I had a kid, a 16-year-old, who was fluent in English, which is rare there today, and he was willing to teach 3,000 hours in order to be going to Burma in order to learn Vipassana Buddhism. Okay, fine. So the foundation could make an agreement with him, a contract. Fine. So then the kid starts teaching English, or he could have, and his phone number is his account number. The Dora account number is his phone number. Second thing is, all the nonprofits, most nonprofits has a teaching or learning component. You know, you could have either an ecological one or a teaching one, an elderly one. I mean, they have components that could be part of it. And they become part of organizing the activities of learning that are relevant for their stuff. Just like a business. A business does this in the dollar or euro or the lita economy. They would do this in the dora economy. And their own staff can be paid in doras. Finally, when you assume that you finished your 3,000 hours, you go to the Lithuanian Learning Foundation and they realize your dream. They provide you with the resources. They have raised the frequent flyer miles to pay for the tickets. They are providing the contacts in Burma where is a safe and a good place to do this. And they realize a dream. At the end of the whole period, I was there for 4 days on this project. I talked to the kid and say, your English is really amazing. You know, would you not like to be paid in euros or in dollars or in lita for doing this? He said, oh, no. That just gets me the airline ticket. I want litas. That realizes my dream. So you create Doras. Realize my dream. You can create a superior currency to the national currency if the attraction is strong enough. All right. Examples of projects. This is a project related to having teenagers teach adults how to use the internet. And both of them earn doras. If the elderly person has no particular dream anymore, he can give it to his grandchild. An economy. Another example is Wisdom Archive. This is for kids in primary school, lower than 12, they approach an elderly person, more than 70, and ask one question. What did you learn in your life that will be relevant for my life? And they make a tape of that. They can make a video of that. They can make a multimedia product. If you just do an audio tape, you get $50. If you do a multimedia product, you get $100. And every year, we have a competition for the 10 best contributions of the year, and you get $3,000. Cost to everybody, zero. Okay? So, in other words, you can create a whole activity that otherwise would not occur. Now, let's switch to the other component, the coercive part, which is less fun. I would say the government issues looks like this today. In early railroad industry, they had one track for the two directions. Okay? And then once in a while, this happened. Okay? Now we have learned better. We have two tracks. So why not do that for money? Okay? I call that a civic. The civic solves a government problem, the budgetary constraints, particularly anything related to labor components. You don't build buildings or buy cars with civics, okay? But you'd get a lot of labor done in the social domain, in the environmental domain, in the learning domain, or whatever domain that is high labor input. It would create a parallel economy that actually parallels the official national currency, where the NGOs become the key actors as organizers for social activities at the scale of the city. And it makes possible a Keynesian relaunch for the economists among you without creating debt, which is particularly interesting these days. The reason that I claim we're in a worse situation now than in the 30s is in the 30s the governments were not indebted. So the Keynesian relaunch was possible. And that's what they did, actually, with the war. The war was the Keynesian relaunch of the time. Okay? Well, here's a mechanism to do this, and I would recommend on a decentralized level, without creating debt. Here's how it works. Here is the systemic view on how we deal today with these kind of issues, with social issues, cooperative economics. You have non-profit organizations that get a tax exemption for doing good things for the community, and you have the government raising taxes to then provide subsidies to other things like education, scholarships, whatever else. That's how we do it with a single currency. Here is what I propose. You create two wheels. It's a bicycle with two wheels. Or another metaphor, it's a railroad system with two tracks. You have still the conventional, everything that's there is fine. We create a new one with a civic, and that's a currency that's cooperative and insufficiency as opposed to be scarce and competitive. Now, any activity happening in that economy can still be taxed in the currency of that economy, i.e. the national currency. There is a second thing happening, however. The city issues its own currency, or the region issues its own currency, and if you want to live in that city, you need to provide a contribution in that currency. I call them civics. The unit of account could be an hour. Okay? And you earn them by doing things that the city wants, like I explained for the Torica. But this is now obligation. Now, let's assume that I'm a guy who is not interested in all this stuff. Fine. No problems. You create an eBay-type market where you exchange. I need to buy the civics from someone who's done that kind of work. And we create a free market. There's no fixed exchange rate. A free market on getting those civics. And they are actually the people who don't do anything for whatever good or bad reason are providing an income in national currency to the people who are doing more than their share. So this is a way to resolve the kind of problems we are currently dealing with. By the way, I would say Greece should go that way. Okay? I'm not saying that we should go that way in Switzerland today. Situation isn't bad enough. But if you're going to have 50% unemployment in a town and you don't have the money to pay your teachers, this is the way to go. Fine. Conclusion. A couple of pictures that replace a lot of words. I would say, realistically, this is a good picture of the current status of the monetary system on a global level. We're actually competing today to find out whether it's the dollar or the euro that will fall apart first. Interesting. The first and the second global currency are competing on a race. Second point is this picture. This is not coming from a French leftist journal, as you may suspect. This is coming from The Economist. Okay? The third picture summarizes the whole book, which I'm not going to bother you with. But if you would, in one box, all patriarchal societies in history, Sumer, Babylon, Greece, Rome, and since the Renaissance, the Western world, and by the way, the developed world, the entire world, okay, you have the same system for the last 5,000 years. It's a monopoly of a single currency with interest. Interest was invented in Sumer, and writing was invented in Sumer for that purpose. Okay? Now, there are positive things about that. I would claim that without such an approach, you would never have had the Industrial Revolution. It would simply not have happened. However, it's also the boom and bust cycles that we're so familiar with are generated in that environment. It concentrates systematically wealth through the process of interest. Interest is a mechanism to extract from the majority to a minority resources systemically. And finally, it's not compatible with the community. The more developed you become in that economy, the less you have a community. Now, do you want to know whether you're in a patriarchal society? There's a simple way. If the image of the divine is a guy with a beard who created it all without a girlfriend, you are very likely in a patriarchal society. Now, we believe sometimes that there's nothing else. That's not true. We have matrifocal societies. You may notice I use the word matrifocal and not matriarchal, because matriarchal societies have never existed. In a matriarchal society, a hardcore matriarchal society, the male would be reduced to procreation. That is in the mythology of the Amazons, and there's never been an anthropological, archaeological, or historical community that actually has done that. Matrifocal societies are societies that honor feminine values. And there are examples, for example, several thousand years, the history of dynastic Egypt. And in the Western world, in Europe, from the 10th to the 13th century, the time period called the era of cathedrals, these cathedrals were built for a lady, okay? Not for Jesus Christ and not for the Pope, all right? So in those societies, what they have in common is a dual currency system. You have one currency type identical to the patriarchal one, and very often that patriarchal one, in other words, the currency that the neighbors use, to trade with people you don't know, long distance. And then there's a second system, bottom-up, what we call today complementary currencies, social purpose complementary currencies, that actually have no interest, but at a more sophisticated level, as Mrs. Farr has mentioned, the rusting, you know, the monnaie fondante. In Egypt, they had the monnaie fondante for several thousand years in that local currency. So that's a currency that's purely medium of exchange. No store of value. And it creates a very different dynamic because everybody has money, including slaves. Okay? So that created economic stability for centuries. No business cycle and no boom and bust cycles for 250 years in Western Europe, okay, and for thousands of years in Egypt, okay? All right? It is the society where the little people were living the best. There is actually hard evidence that the highest standard of living, the ordinary European, was in the 12th century if you're an ordinary European, not today. And we can measure this by the size of the bones and the size of the people. women today in London, which is the place where we have the data, are 1 centimeter shorter than the women of the 12th century. Okay? So there's hard data here. Fine. Complete. Thank you very much.
Check out our other podcasts, available free on the iTunes Store. For more information, go to our website, www.unris.org. Thank you for listening.